This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Growing Pains, the coming-of-age narrative in speculative fiction.
So, this episode is sort of a byproduct of a recent episode that we've had.
Yeah, when we were doing the episode on identity, we had this as a subcategory and then realised how huge it was.
Mm. And we suddenly went, oh my god, we could really do a whole episode on this. So we decided that we'd cut that bit short in that episode and actually really focus in on it, because it's such an interesting topic.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I suppose the other thing that sort of put it in my mind, in fact, what put it in my mind initially to write down for the identity episode, was some flattering soul added me to a list of, not me personally, added my books to a list of alternative coming of age young adult stories to certain author who is in people's bad books at the moment. Which, right. You know, is vastly overstating my appeal, I think, but, you know. That was nice, and I thought, well, actually, it is kind of something that I've tapped into, even though that wasn't really something I was looking at when I was writing the book, so I was just compelled by the story.
Yeah.
But stepping back and looking at it, it's a really interesting thing to sort of deconstruct.
Mm.
So, what do we mean by a coming-of-age narrative? Basically, this is a narrative or a sub-narrative within a larger story or series, which hinges on one or more characters basically putting away their childhoods and accepting or coming to terms with the responsibilities of being an adult, which makes it sound really simple, but actually it's an incredibly painful thing to do.
It is, and I think its vast appeal is that it's something that is inherently human. And I think something else which is worth noting is that even though this is a narrative which is, you know, very often put to teenagers and things like that, there is an element of truth to it in terms of becoming an adult as well, a little bit later on in life, and the idea of putting certain things aside and growing, because we continue to grow, which is why it is such a compelling narrative device, but also why I would say it's an essential one that we turn to and that we write about, whether consciously or not.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Cliff Notes version is, as I've said, with the addendum that the biggest adult responsibility you'll ever be asked to shoulder is your own actions. You cannot control everything else in the universe. In fact, the only thing you can reliably control is how you behave. And yet somehow that's more difficult than getting into lots of drama over various other things that you actually cannot control, rather than dealing with what you can control and trying to look at things logically. It's really, really difficult for us, I think, to separate out how we feel from how we should act.
Definitely. Absolutely.
To be honest, every time I go on Twitter at the moment, I'm reminded of that particular thing. Maybe it's an age thing for me, simply because I've obviously gone through, I'm so far away from the young adult stage now that I can actually look at it with a fair bit of objectivity. But I just still remember what it was like. So on the one hand, it's kind of like, yeah, I understand the impulse for drama and to really feel everything. But from my perspective, where I am now, it's kind of like, it really wasn't the end of the world.
But it felt like it at the time.
It felt like it at the time. So that leads us on to, so why exactly is it such an appealing narrative? Well, as Madeleine said, it's something we've all gone through. I mean, hopefully we have all gone, unless you're a very, very young listener who has not yet reached the stage of being a teenager. We have all gone through the stage of being a teenager and going from that transitionary period from being a child to being an adult. Most of us get to our early 20s and forget what it's like.
Yeah.
And that's no judgment. That's actually kind of a natural thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that actually that is something which means that past 20-year-olds tend to sort of look down on teenagers because they are going through that phase, which I don't think is particularly fair, because it's a crucial stage, and it's a stage which is messy and painful and difficult, and which nothing has really prepared you for, because it doesn't just all happen on one level, it's happening on several levels, and for some teenagers it happens all at once. And that's really hard to deal with, along with everything else that you're going through.
Definitely. I mean, you get lots of, let's say adult is from sort of 21 onwards, and that's a very that's a very low estimate, actually, because really your frontal lobes haven't finished developing until you're about 24, 25.
Yeah.
But let's say adult behaviour is expected of you from the age of 21 onwards, to a certain extent. The fact that people over that age sort of deride teenagers for being melodramatic is kind of insulting, because obviously their perspective is valid. They're working out who they are. Of course they're going to clash with adults and with children. They don't really fit in either space because they don't know who they are yet.
Yeah.
So their experiences are completely valid. And yes, everything is the end of the world, because there is nothing at that time that is more important than them working out where they fit in, where their boundaries are, and you know how to sort of form a peace, whatever, with other people.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that, you know, as adults, we can look back and we say that was very dramatic, over the top, but it doesn't change the quality of feeling which is felt at those times by teenagers of those times. Those feelings are real, and they do have real physical consequences as well, which is why to diminish that and to not see it as important and crucial is actually quite dangerous, because, you know, young people will be affected by what's happening during those periods, and by how they feel. People do end up hurting themselves, they end up committing suicide, or they end up actually getting into very dangerous situations, or situations which have long consequences deep into adulthood. And I also think that that's why it is so compelling in narrative, because this isn't just a time where teenagers are changing and developing and in that crucial, you know, stage. It's also a time when they are at their most vulnerable and their most malleable.
Yeah, definitely. From a biological imperative point of view, it is absolutely natural for us as a species to have what the Amish would call Rumspringer, you know, the running around years, where you do act out and you are a little bit wild and you go a bit further and you take risks and you indulge in behaviour that perhaps isn't actually the best idea. And the reason for this, we think, on an anthropological level, is the fact that when we all lived as sort of tribal societies, having young people who were kind of like willing to go out away from home and form new units was extremely beneficial to a species that was trying to continue itself. So it makes perfect sense. And we actually haven't changed that much, believe it or not, since we lived in caves.
No, it's actually been that long.
It hasn't been that long. It's literally 0.1% of our DNA has changed at all. In the last, so what, 40 to 50,000 years, even longer. So, that's insane when you think about it. So, yeah, all those things are really important. So you have all this going on. You have the fact that as teenagers, you're not actually making decisions with your frontal lobes as you do as an adult. You're making decisions with the amygdala. The amygdala is the lizard brain. The lizard brain is about survival. You know, that's where really intense emotions such as anger and fear come from. So because the frontal lobes haven't developed to a sufficient level yet for, you know, forward thinking behavior, forward thinking planning, all the decisions are being made at that sort of lizard brain part of the human brain.
Mm.
Hence, teenagers don't seem to be looking forward. They don't seem to have any concept of the future or planning. That's perfectly natural. They don't have the brains for that yet. And again, that's no insult. That's just a biological fact.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to really consider about that is that this is what's happening biologically. And then you also have to really consider what's happening in terms of their surroundings, because these are young people who are now starting to push back, who are starting to get their own sense of autonomy and identity, but they're still in a very restricted society. And restricted in, you know, they're at school, they're being told they've got to think about all of these very important things, and these things are incredibly important. But the problem is that you're asking all these people who have not really developed that forward-thinking part of the brain. Again, that's nothing to say that I'm not saying they're all naturally immature or anything like that. It's not me going against them, nor is it me saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's quite unfair that you have these, you know, these people who are going through basically everything at once, being told to think about the future while they're not necessarily developed in order to be able to do so, and then being told this is going to have an effect on the rest of your life. That's insane, the amount of pressure that's being put on top. It really does feel like, particularly these days, teenagers are just being ripped in all directions at once, and they're all doing that while trying to figure out who they are and becoming adults.
Yeah, it is absolutely the perfect storm, isn't it? Case of brain is not fully developed, pituitary gland has just woken up and started flooding you with hormones. You're on a fundamental biological level compelled to sort of engage in risk-taking behaviour and to seek out new people and make new friends, new partnerships and things.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we say, oh yeah, you're going to make several really important life decisions that you can't take back at this age as well.
Yeah. So that's difficult.
Yeah, so it's not great. And obviously it doesn't matter how mature a teenager is. I was incredibly old for my age, and yet there were still times when I felt completely alienated from everything around me. Mm. And I definitely, my sense of proportion of things was correspondingly different to how it would be now. So something that would have been like literally the end of the world for me as a teenager now is kind of like, ah, that kind of sucks, meh, you know. And it's probably a vice versa thing. The things that I would be like, I'd attribute lots of importance to now as a teenager, I'd be kind of like, they're you know, I can't see them, they're a dot on the horizon. So everybody goes through that.
Yeah. And I think there is the problem with maturity in youth is that actually it can also be compensating underdevelopment in other areas.
Yeah, absolutely. This is where, obviously, adding a speculative element to a story can go to one of two ways, really. It can be absolutely ludicrous at great speed, because you're kind of like, okay, so you're doing this. Let's think of all that little list of biological things that are all going on, that biological checklist, and the fact that they're having to make life decisions. This might be the first time they're really engaging with someone on a romantic level as well. And yeah, let's throw in an apocalypse.
Yay!
And it's kind of like, there's too much. There are too many things on that list. So in that respect, yes, it's ridiculous. On the other hand, speculative fiction coming of age is definitely important, because the speculative elements often represent internal teenage struggles that are hard to contextualise.
Yes.
Even for that age group. So you have a ghost story, for example, and that's about being a teenager and doing your coming of age thing and coming to terms with grief and understanding death on an adult level.
Yeah, absolutely.
For example.
And you have a coming of age story where someone is actually literally trying to stop a dictatorship and the dystopian world and the end of the world, and it's because that's actually kind of what it feels like they're dealing with, the end of their world. Because in some ways, it is the end of their world. That transition from being a child into an adult, it's the end of a particular world, and you never quite go back to it. Even in your, you know, even when you are desperately sort of looking back to childhood and trying to really recapture that, there are parts of it that you can just never, ever really go back to at all. And it is this consciousness of the rest of the world, it's this sense of consequence It's the, you know, nihilistic dread.
Yeah, you've been, effectively, you've been banished from Narnia. You may have had great adventures that put you in danger as a child kind of thing.
Yeah.
But because you didn't understand the danger on an adult level, it was something completely different. And you lose a lot of magic as well along the way.
Yeah, definitely. And so I think that there is this sense of the end of the world, because it is the end of a world. It's the end of an era. And that is really difficult to deal with.
Definitely. Okay, so my theory for coming of age is that it's about learning how to value yourself. It's your last separation from child. So you realise that this is going to sound very bleak, by the way, but I want you to sort of think about what I'm saying and then realise actually it's not bleak, because it gives you all the choices. It puts all the power back in your hands. But you realise you're alone. Mm. I don't think you really realise that as a child in the same way, because children are naturally geared from a very early age to see themselves as the centre of the universe, and then gradually allow more and more people into the universe who become as real as they are, hopefully, yeah. If you follow a normal course of development. And then you reach the stage where your parents aren't God anymore, which is quite a scary part as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think you get to being the sort of age of being a teenager, and at some point it really clicks in that nobody's coming to save you. In fact, nobody's coming to save anyone. That's one of the most brutal truths. No one's coming to save you. Ever. Yeah. The only thing that's going to happen is you can learn to save yourself. So your importance is not predicated on someone else's opinion. Your value doesn't lie in what someone else thinks of you. These are very difficult things for a teenager to take on at a time when obviously you really want to be liked, because you've got this biological imperative driving you to seek out other people, which means you desperately want to be liked, even before social media starts bombarding you with images of what you should look like.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does all seem really, really bleak, but what it all comes down to is all the power for how you act is in your hands. And I think that's one of the hardest things to take away from a coming-of-age story.
Yeah, absolutely. power is definitely the right word. Because, and that's, again, definitely a way that the speculative element really comes into it, because there is that sense of power, but as, you know, it's the Spider-Man quote, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah, you can't have one without the other, unfortunately. It's not a case if you wake up and, oh great, I can shoot laser beams out of my eyes, therefore I can do it all the time. There are consequences. I suppose that's the thing. There are actions, there are consequences. There is power.
But there's also this idea that actually, by taking responsibility, you also gain power as well. That it's two things that are combined together. One comes with the other.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? One of the most powerful things you can do is actually accept yourself. Which I get sounds a bit sort of like very hashtag self-care. But I genuinely mean that on a really gritty, messy, horrible, let's do some very painful self-examination level.
Yeah.
That probably the greatest thing you can do power wise is to learn to accept yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not something which is easy. And I think the other thing about the coming of age story is that, in particularly, you know, society today, we're coming to the understanding that this is not a single, it doesn't all happen at once. It's not one mountain you climb and then you go, ta-da, and that's
it. No, absolutely not.
It's a mountain range, and it happens at various points in your life, and we continue to develop, because ultimately, even though, you know, there is a biological element of sort of what happens in your brain, in terms of what's developing at times, we haven't changed species from going from a child into an adult.
I mean, it may seem like it, but that's definitely not what's happened.
Age is an illusion.
Was it Neil Gaiman who said, is it a young fan asked him, you know, said he wanted to be a writer when he grew up, and Neil Gaiman said something along the lines of, yes, definitely be a writer, but don't worry about growing up, just get older.
Yes.
I'm paraphrasing. Neil Gaiman obviously said it much better than that, as you would expect.
My dad always had a joke, which is he's just said, like, I still haven't decided what I want to be when I grow up. And it got to a stage when I was like, I don't know, maybe retired. But it does bring up this element, which is that you don't inexplicably just stop the moment you become an adult. That journey does still continue. And here we have, you know, Joseph Campbell sort of scootering in.
Yes.
He's just got on a little moped. Doot, doot, as he comes in, waving as he goes past. And yeah, it's also why you have that whole idea of the building's Roman and, you know, the hero's journey, why they can also be linked in. But really, that first big hill that you sort of start to step across, it's the idea that you start sort of going over molehills and little mountain ranges as you grow up as a child, and then you really hit the proper mountain when you get to teenage years.
Yeah. To use a karate aphorism, black belt isn't the end of the journey. Black belt is where they're basically your first apprentice. You're now judged to be fit to actually practice karate without hurting yourself, basically. And it's a bit like being a teenager in the sense of when you get to being a teenager, that's when you should be learning to question things. I mean, you should have been questioning things as a child, hopefully, if you haven't been squashed. But once you get to teenager, that's when you learn to question everything, including yourself. And you learn that actually there aren't any easy answers, hopefully. And this is an ongoing process. This isn't something that hopefully stops. I realise it has probably for some people, and that's very sad, but it's something that you can always re-engage with. I think it's realizing that actually nobody's got the real answer. There's no big button that you press at the end of the game and you get a prize.
And that life is messy, and it is also the illusion that there is no one adult who has everything sorted out. Everyone is scrabbling. No one really knows what they're doing.
I'm gonna be 41 in a week's time, and I'm like, I still do things where I think, well, I feel really grown up having done that. And then I'll laugh at myself. There'll be something really stupid, like, I don't know. Something typically sort of mundane and boring and adult that I've, you know, haven't actually done before.
Yep. I know the feeling. So, yeah. It's an illusion. It's all an illusion, people.
Okay, let's have a look at some types of coming-of-age narrative that you might find in speculative fiction. We're going to go a little bit off the tracks in the sense of there will be a couple of sort of more contemporary or more sort of historically type bits and pieces as well, because definitely. They also serve as good illustrations. So the one that I'm sure everyone will be familiar with is the first love trope.
Ah, yes.
That's very classically coming-of-age. And in most cases, not all, but most cases, the first love trope kind of, it sort of ends in a bittersweet way. It very rarely ends with the two teens staying together forever. Mm. But it teaches you something really, really important along the way, I think. So let's look at some examples. So one of the greatest, for me, one of the best examples of this is I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is not actually, again, speculative, but it's written in such a beautiful, rich way that it feels speculative when I read it. And it's basically about this family. There's two girls, an older sister Rose and a younger sister Cassandra. And their father, who was a brilliant writer and wrote some literary masterpiece that he lived off for decades. And then he got writer's block for something like 20 years. And just the family, I mean, when they start, when he's at the height of his fame, she's kind of like the narrator, Cassandra, is about 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. Mm. And they take a drive out into the country and they find this crumbling castle. And he says, you know, this is where we're going to live. And then you come back in a bit later and you have Cassandra and Rose who are basically grown up. Cassandra's about sort of 19. No, Cassandra's 17, sorry. her sister's about 1920. And the father is just like not producing anything. He's just had such bad writer's block. And they're still living in this castle. They're still renting it. The mother unfortunately died, and now there's a stepmother who gets on with both girls very, very well. And there's obviously a little brother as well. And it's funny and it's tragic, and it takes a look at family as well. And they're poor. They're living in a castle, but they can barely afford to eat. They can't afford to heat the rooms. They can't afford hot water. And you're treated to this scene quite early on, how Cassandra is sitting writing in her diary. And she starts with, "I'm sitting writing this in the kitchen sink," because literally it's the driest place when everything's raining. Because the castle is this leaky. And Rose is very dissatisfied with her life. Rose is very pretty, and this is not what she wanted. Anyway, yeah. Two very wealthy young American lads come to stay at a local big manor house. They sort of inherit it, I think, from English relatives. And a sort of friendship strikes up, but it's unequal in the way, because Rose is determined she's not going to live like this anymore. So she really makes a beeline for the elder of the two brothers, the one who'll inherit. And it just turns into this sort of tragicomedy type thing, because Cassandra's trying to help her sister because her sister wants out. And it's a case of, well, you know, do you think you could love him? Because, you know, he has a beard. Can you imagine kissing a man with a beard kind of thing? And Rose is like, I would kiss Satan himself for a tangerine lipstick, you know?
Yeah.
It's really beautifully done. Because she's not being, to use the modern parlance, a gold digger. She's just sort of, I cannot literally see a way to survive. And I don't want to live like this. This is not what I, in my youth, want. I want pretty clothes. I want, and he's a nice enough person. Yeah. It goes horribly wrong, though, because Rose gets engaged to the older brother and then falls in love with the younger brother. Meanwhile, Cassandra falls in love with the older brother. And it turned into a really painful coming-of-age first love trope where Cassandra's trying to process her feelings. All of this is through Cassandra's diary. And they're obviously dealing with their father, trying to push him into actually writing something so he can make some more money. And the stepmother, who seems to be this very strange free spirit. And it's, you know, in the end, it ends with Rose marrying the younger of the two brothers, and you know they have enough to live on, and the family will sort of accept that, even though it's very painful. It's not fair on Simon, the older brother. And then he sort of says to Cassandra, who's just sort of coming up 18, and bearing in mind this is sort of the 1920s, you know we could get married as well. We get on really well. We like the same sort of music. We had fun. You liked it when I kissed you that one time. And he said, you know, we could have fun going around the world together. Can't you see us sort of knocking about? And Cassandra's desperately in love with him, and she turns him down because she doesn't want to be with somebody who has just offered for her just because, you know, he's brokenhearted over her sister.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of, okay, this is everything I actually want, and the child part of me wants to accept that. But the adult part of me knows that we're both going to end up miserable if I do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting story.
It's very good. There's an excellent film with Romola Garai in it as well. So if you don't want to read the book, definitely the film's a really good compromise.
It's interesting because in some ways, this kind of narrative and the, you know, the first love narrative is almost meant to unteach the lessons that young girls in particular used to be taught from early childhood. And again, we can blame the Victorians with the fairy tales, with these, you know, the princess finds the prince. The happily ever after comes along, which is that that is the pinnacle of being an adult. The princess becomes an adult by meeting her true love and marrying him, and then all is well. Which is, of course, not what life is like, nor is it what relationships are like. People don't just always get on. You can love someone fiercely and still argue about, you know, whose turn it is to take out the laundry.
I want to do the washing up today. No, it's my turn. Believe it or not, that's happened.
It's almost like these books and stuff, in particular in the modern day, are coming out to basically say, yes, and look, she finds her prince, but he's not actually her prince. And we have to destroy that notion of the prince, and also destroy the notion that a woman only has to be a woman and a man only has to be a man for everything to work out immaculately. That relationships take work. And that, I think, is also something which is really essential to the growing up side of things, which is when you're a young kid, you just bump into someone and then it's like, we're friends now, huzzah.
Yes.
We both like playing with bricks. It's like this amazing thing where you see, you know, you have two adult people and they're like, they look at each other like, oh yeah, we've been friends since kindergarten, but why? You have absolutely nothing in common anymore, but it's just because you've just known each other for that long. And you know, it's this actual, this sense of adult relationships don't work in the same way that children's relationships work. It's not enough to just be, and it's because you are suddenly conscientious of the existence of other people as actual people, you
yeah
know?
Yeah, definitely. So other first love examples, we won't go into them in too much detail, but the film Dirty Dancing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's not going to be one that ends with them sailing off into the sunset together. It's just, you know, they're just fundamentally not compatible in that way. But I think it's accepting that now is good, and now you've learned something. You've learned a lot. You've learned a lot about yourself. You've accepted the adult part of yourself. So, and there's a lot of accepting different responsibilities and questioning things and realizing how messy the adult world is in that as well. So it gets a lot of stick, but actually Dirty Dancing's a really good coming of age story.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, definitely. It also explores the idea that actually perhaps, you know, it's okay to also have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, Twilight. Twilight is definitely leaning heavily on the first love thing.
Yes.
Obviously, in Twilight, yes, Bella goes through many, many different trials and things, but there is a happily ever after at the end of it. So it's kind of like with caveats kind of thing. Yes, if you go through all this suffering, you might actually end up with the person that you want. What I find particularly, I'm not going to talk about Twilight too much, but what I find interesting about Twilight is the fact that so many people say that all Bella does is whinge about getting older. And I'm like, I don't think you quite grasp the fact that she knows she's going to stop feeling like this eventually. If she doesn't freeze herself as she is, then she won't be the same. I mean, obviously there's the inequality thing, which is a big issue, but there's also the, she will ultimately outgrow him, and she's wise enough to know this on some level.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's less about wanting immortality and far more about, no, I don't want to give up feeling like this, which is very dramatic in teenage, but, you know, does kind of make a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, you know, there are several levels on it, which is that ultimately, as you said, it's about stopping the clock in Twilight for her. And, you know, there's the biological clock that she wants to stop because she doesn't want to be a different person. She wants to still sort of be with him, and she also kind of doesn't want to make it weird in some ways, if that makes sense. But you're right that there is absolutely this emotional thing. And again, the Twilight really, really does represent the idea that even if you do end up with the first person you really fall in love with, that doesn't mean that love isn't a complicated thing. Because it takes them, you know, three books to actually get together properly. And they do get married, and you know, there's lots of complicated things that are happening there, some that I don't necessarily agree with. But the idea is that, you know, it does actually take them a lot to actually be able to get together properly, and there are a lot of things which do get in their way first. And the speculative element adds that drama to it, because obviously it's the things that are getting in the way are all these other things. But if we look at them as metaphorical, you know, there's a lot to play with there. There's also this tiny idea that maybe women mature a little bit faster than men.
I think it's interesting from the perspective of she starts as an old 17, if you like. So someone who's quite mature for their age at 17, if you compare her to her friends. And then by the time you get to the fourth book, she reads like someone in her mid-20s. And you can understand that with everything she's gone through, probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so other tropes. The main character has had to grow up too fast, and the narrative addresses filling in the gaps. So,
yes.
Someone who's had a huge responsibility put on them for whatever reason, and the narrative sort of acts either as a metaphor or a dark mirror or what have you, and sort of fills in around the edges. Because, as Madeline rightly said earlier, someone who's been forced to be too mature for their age generally has some other level that's arrested developmentally because they have not been able to focus on themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can actually then be personified in childish behaviour coming out in other ways, or inability to deal with certain situations, or risky behaviour. There's lots of ways that it can bring itself forward. And it can also, very interestingly, be used as something to explore slightly older teenagers. So we're not looking so much at the 15, the 16, but, you know, looking at sort of 17 and even 18, you know, getting into those high school years and beyond, because there's this idea that there are some things which have been incompleted, or some things which haven't been allowed to develop in order to let this other side, this maturity, she says in inverted commas, develop instead.
Yeah, definitely. A really good example is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Obviously, she literally has the weight of the world on her shoulders from the age of 15 onwards. And basically, the premise, certainly for the early seasons, is that high school is hell. Which I think most of us can actually understand. Because, yeah, you can, looking back on your school days, can acquire a rosy tint. But when you really, really think about it, was it that great? I mean, I always used to look really askance at people who said to me, oh, you know, these are the best days of your lives. And I'm like, I really hope you're fucking kidding me, because Jesus Christ.
I used to get so depressed every time someone said that. It's like, oh, right now, these are the best days of your life. And I just thought, I should die now then. If life just gets worse, how can this be the top? How can we just snowball into the inevitable... the howling void of Tartarus. Like, I don't want this.
I mean, this is the thing. When you create basically teenager farms in schools where you have all these people who are all working out who they are and trying to exert themselves with adult agency for the first time, it means that you end up with cliques, you end up with behaviour which is not very laudable against each other, and there's a certain amount of insensitivity going on in a lot of cases, and there's jockeying for position. All these things all together, which, you know, would be mitigated in a mixed peer group, are exacerbated when you put classes of, say, 40 17-year-olds together, or 40 15-year-olds. Imagine 40 14 or 15-year-olds all together, or a greater number. It's horrific if you think about it like that. It really is hell.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not that some people are just made to be bullies or whatever, or that you're always going to get your group of mean girls, or you're always going to get your group of tough guys, even though that does seem to happen. all these like 40 really, really insecure people who think they're adults and want to be able to act like adults but can't yet without properly developed frontal lobes. You know, this is a recipe for disaster. I mean, you might as well try teaching a group of hyenas in some respects. So yeah, of course there's going to be fallout, and of course people are going to do each other damage, and it's horrible. And there are some people who are genuinely sort of, they just came out of the box a bit wrong, or what they're doing is they're processing their own personal traumas by offloading them on other people.
Yes.
There's no excuse for that, by the way, because I think once you reach 14 or 15, you're old enough to start considering that your actions are your own responsibility. So that takes us back to the start. But yeah, Buffy does this very well. So it balances the supernatural with the idea that high school, even without the supernatural and even without it being literally in a hellmouth, is still a really horrible place to be, a nasty place to try and navigate.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. The next one, and again, this is a really, really popular one as well, is when the main character needs to defeat an insecurity or a vulnerability which is within themselves. Now, you often get this. Weirdly enough, this is one that really comes out in a lot of martial arts, sort of
martial arts. Unsurprisingly, to be honest.
Yeah, unsurprising, which is usually it's nerdy kid or someone who isn't, you know, quite pushing through and is sort of being held back a little bit by something which is inside of them. You know, it might be some kind of hurt. It might be some kind of chip on their shoulder. It might be, usually it's a form of insecurity or vulnerability. And they get a mentor, of course. And they have to sort of go on this journey, and there's usually this really physical side of it, like, I've learned to fight, therefore I am confident in myself.
It is a great metaphor in a lot of respect. I think it's a metaphor that probably bears up more if you've actually had that experience as a martial artist. So you've gone in, you've gone in being the person who knew nothing, and you've toughed it out, and you've come to the end with, no, actually, even if I'm not actually a particularly good fighter, then I have some sort of physical confidence. This has bolstered my self-esteem, because this is something I have acquired. I've gone out and I've got it. And it doesn't have to be martial arts. I mean, I put The Karate Kid down as a coming-of-age film for this, because it is a great coming-of-age film. It's very, very 80s now. With the proper 80s power ballad soundtrack. Oh yeah, man. 80s hair all the way.
Yeah.
And
but you also get it in like Forbidden Kingdom, I think, as well. And
yeah, totally. And it's good in the sense of, because it, with The Karate Kid, obviously, it's a very classic, you know, new kid comes to town, falls foul of the local bullies kind of thing. And then overcomes it. And obviously through learning karate. He's not just randomly called The Karate Kid.
What? Shocking.
But I think that the whole idea of settling it all in a tournament kind of makes a great metaphor, because tournament fighting is very controlled. So it's a case of, we needed to have this physical fisticuffs fight, but, you know, we're having it with refs. Yeah. And there is respect at the end for the person who actually beat them. He's not just beating the other person who's been bullying him. He's actually beating something within himself.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, because there's, for me, I think there's an offshoot of this type as well. Which is actually really well explored in I mentioned it the other week, My Hero Academia.
Yeah.
Which, for me, is one of these really, really nice coming-of-age stories, because it actually explores the idea of coming-of-age in terms of overcoming sort of the self-doubt and vulnerability which is within yourself, and overcoming projection as well. The main character in My Hero Academia is called Midoriya Izuku.
Yeah.
Just call him Midoriya. So Midoriya, in a world where everybody has a kind of superpower, Midoriya is one of the very, very low percentage of people who was born without one, which is difficult because Midoriya has always wanted to be a superhero.
Right.
and he's bullied mercilessly because he doesn't have a quirk, to the extent that one person literally says, you want a quirk, the best thing you can do is probably jump off the school building and hope you'll get one in your next life.
Harsh.
You know, yeah, seriously harsh. And he's physically bullied, he's bullied, and he even so, he's still applying to a special school to become a hero, despite the fact that he doesn't have a quirk. And he totally idolizes this other superhero called All Might. And he impresses All Might. I won't go into details, but he impresses All Might. And All Might actually turns around in the end and says, you can be a superhero. I believe in you. And without giving away too many spoilers, this does happen right at the beginning. All Might basically gives him a superpower.
Yeah.
It's complicated, but it gives him a superpower. And a big part of Midoriya's journey is that, first of all, he cannot control the superpower at all, to the point that when he uses it, it literally breaks his bones.
Oh, no.
It's kind of funny.
That's very Japanese.
It really is, but there was just this one shot where he's punched something and you can see his arm's broken, and then I was looking at the animation and going, they did that animation really weird because his legs are moving really weirdly, and I thought, I don't know why they've done it like that, until you realise that both of his legs are broken as well. So they're just flapping weirdly.
Oh,
it's horrifying.
Yes.
Yeah, but also quite funny. But also, yeah, he repeatedly breaks his bones whenever he's using the superpower because he's not made it his own. He hasn't learned to control it. And a big part of his journey as he sort of comes to control it is actually realizing that, first of all, he's just trying to be All Might in some ways. He's just trying to copy him. He's doing everything that he does. And also he's not really thinking of the power as his own. He's still thinking of it as All Might's power, that he doesn't deserve it. And a big part of that is actually to let go of his insecurity of saying, well, I don't deserve it. I'm not worthy. You know, the literal world has told me that I'm not worthy. And actually saying, no, this is my power and I'm going to use it my way and I'm going to create my own techniques and I'm going to be my own person. And in learning to do that and learning to sort of accept that as who he is instead, he stops hurting himself. And it works as a fantastic metaphor for growing up, particularly growing up under the wing of someone who you idolise. Rather than it being this traumatic thing, it's this very positive thing, which has unintended trauma, because it's suddenly this, I want to be like you, but I can't be you, and coming to the term of actually saying, but I can be myself instead.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's really, really wonderful, and it's a really nice way of using that insecurity and that vulnerability and learning to defeat it by accepting your own worth in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, the next one, we won't necessarily need to go into this too much because I think everyone's familiar with it, but this is a very young adult type trope, but it does turn up in others as well. And it's the call to revolution, coming of age trope, which is perfectly understandable because this is the time when you're sort of really thinking and you're trying to exert your adult agency. So it makes a lot of sense that something like, you know, the Hunger Games would exist. She's still dealing with the fact that, you know, she's making that transition from child to adult. And yet at the same time, they're trying to topple a corrupt government and replace it with something better. And, you know, the stuff that happens is horribly traumatizing all the way through. So that's a really good example. And there are many, many others. There's lots of Hunger Games imitators out there. The other example for that would also be growing up during war times. And again, there are many books. I mean, if you think about it, this isn't a deliberate, obviously, trope, but if you look at the Diary of Anne Frank, this also, you can read it, even though it's non-fiction, as a coming-of-age story of someone who's growing up during the backdrop of a war and terrible things happening and what effect that has on your development. And there's also The Morning Gift by Ava Ibbotson, which is a favourite book of mine. The main character, Ruth, is 20 years old, so sort of not really in that young adult bracket, but also not really an adult either, not fully. And the book is sort of predicated on the idea that in order to get her out of Austria, her father's younger professor friend, he's only sort of 10 years older than Ruth, the only way he can get her out on his British passport is to marry her. So they do, and they keep, obviously they're not together or anything, and they keep it secret until they can get an annulment in England, but they have to stay married for a year first so that she gets naturalized as a British citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And it all goes horribly wrong because they keep trying to avoid each other. Meanwhile, the Second World War's going on. Ruth is dealing with her family's poverty because, you know, she comes from a family of, you know, they're like one quarter Jewish, but by that point during the Second World War, the roundup was so extreme that she would have been shipped off to a camp if she hadn't got out of Austria.
Yeah.
And her family's separated from waiting in England. And that, you know, it sort of highlights the way that we treated the Jews who came into England at the time. We weren't the heroes. we weren't terrible either, but there was a lot of education that really needed to happen. Anyway, Ruth is brought in and she managed to get a scholarship to a university because she's very bright. And guess who turns out to be her professor? And they're kind of like we keep trying to avoid each other so that we can get this annulled, but they keep bumping into each other, and they can't deny the fact that they are actually friends with each other. They do like each other. Ruth is kind of engaged to somebody else, and they're trying to keep it quiet until they can get it annulled. And then one thing leads to another, and they end up falling in love with each other, despite their best efforts. So it is quite hopeful, even though it's set against the backdrop of war. And it does follow this sort of, what does this situation, how does it affect your development at that stage of your life?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The next one, which can actually also be a mixture of the call to revolution and the sort of growing up in war times, is also The Future Looms.
Yeah.
Which is that suddenly the, oh my god, I've got to make decisions, the future is looming, what am I supposed to do with my life? And this is when there is a physical change happening as well as a, you know, an emotional one. And this, you know, really works in terms of sort of college stories, which is, you know, this is the end of our school life, this is the end of time with my group of friends, and then we're all going to go off to different schools and things are going to change, or we're going to move, or, you know, ultimately there is something which is happening which is causing the end of an era. And it's not necessarily that the era itself is perfect, you know, things can be very, very difficult still, but it's comfortable. It's in so much as it's something that they know, and they know how to operate, you know, the devil that you know and all that jazz. Yeah. I think a perfect example of this is The Rest of Us Just Live Here.
Yeah, and that absolutely is a perfect example. Because obviously, as we've discussed it before, and when Madeline originally brought it up, you have all these typical young adult tropes of the world ending, adventures happening, and kids being asked to deal with things on top of being teenagers in the backdrop. And yet the main focus is on the guys who are kind of like, we're not the chosen ones, we're just basically... Like, the important stuff for us is which college are we going to, and the fact that the person I like seems to be going out with someone else, and I'm trying to deal with feelings of jealousy, and is that really the person I want, and, you know, should we be having sex kind of thing?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think The Rest of Us Just Live Here works really well for me. I think some people don't like it. I know a few people don't like it because they actually want to know, they want the speculative fiction story. They don't want the contemporary story. But it works well for me because it really, really does highlight those very real concerns that people face and the difficulties that people have, particularly, and this is really important, particularly teens who've developed support groups with their other friends. which is something that happens very frequently with, you know, young teenagers. They cannot rely on adults, and that might be for a number of reasons. Perhaps the school system is letting them down. Perhaps they feel like they can't speak to their parents, either because they can't or because they, you know, they just don't realise that they can. They don't think their parents will understand. You know, there's all sorts of numbers of things. And in some ways, the Wicker King, which we talked about a little while ago, has a very similar kind of idea, which is we cannot rely on adults. The adults around us cannot help us out. And so you have these friendship groups that form, you know, support for one another. They're reliant on each other. And then all at once, you know, that friendship group is being torn apart by something which should be exciting, and for which for some of them it is exciting. And yet at the same time, this structure which has been keeping them all together mentally, in terms of mental health, probably not always in the most healthy way, but has been, as far as they're concerned, keeping them together, is crumbling. And that's not something which is discussed enough, I think.
No, I completely agree with that. And unfortunately, that's the sort of life renovation that needs to happen. Because you can't build something else without getting the old crumbling structure out the way. But yeah, it's really painful, and it's very scary when it happens. No one really tells you that one of the suckiest things about your 20s is discovering that about half of the friends you made as a teenager or as a child are not probably going to be featuring in your life. And that's okay, it's just that your paths have diverged and they've got to follow their own star and you've got to follow yours, kind of thing. You know what? You might end up crossing paths again in your 40s or even later, you don't know. But for the time being, you've kind of got to be okay with the fact that you cannot hold on to things and make them stay the same.
No, particularly if you yourself have changed. It's also, I think that is something that can actually frequently happen in these kinds of stories, where one character is not ready for change, and that's what they're struggling with. And that's definitely the case, I think, in The Rest of Us Just Live Here. I've forgotten what the main character is
so called. Have I. I'm afraid all that's stuck in my head with name-wise is the indie kids.
Yeah, all I can think of is Finn, because there's several of them.
The third Finn, the one with the stormy eyes and the jet black hair.
But the main character, he's not ready for the change to happen at all.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else kind of almost is in some ways, and they're almost excited for it, and he's not, and he wants stuff to stay the same. They did the same actually a little bit in one of the later seasons of Teen Wolf with Styles, and Scott and things like that. And I do think it's actually a really important narrative, so that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, quite a common one for young adult fiction and for the coming of age is sexual awakening. It doesn't always have to be about love. Sometimes it's a case of, I've got all these feelings and I don't know what to do with them.
American Pie teaches us this.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a great coming of age story in some ways, but
no,
yeah.
It really isn't, and yet it's the first one. It's just, oh god, I just remember it's suddenly circling. I guess it was the two things that sort of started circling in school that I remember. The first one was Grease, and then it was... It was American Pie.
That's quite the combo. Circling the drain, I think, maybe. On this way down. It's funny, gross out humour. But I think the thing with Sexual Awakening, and particularly if we're looking at specifically young adult fiction as a coming of age story, because not all coming of age has to be young adult, it can be aimed at much older people or much younger. Is the fact there seem to be two schools of thought. The people who are like, yeah, we're fine with on-page sexual activity between teenagers. And the school of thought that says, no, this is anathema, you know, burn those books, kind of thing. And never the twain shall meet on those two perspectives. I fall more into the primary category, because while I don't think you should necessarily be writing erotica, I think it's healthier to depict it as something natural.
Yes.
And a normal part of your development. Even if you personally don't feel that way, let's take any shame out of it. Let's have people talking about it openly.
Yeah, because otherwise they're going to learn about it in places which are not necessarily the best place to learn about them.
And, you know, all kinds as well. So I've got, I can't remember the name of the authors for these, it's not good. Echo After Echo is about a girl who goes off to become an actress in theatre and ends up falling in love with one of the stagehands, and, you know, there's a sapphic relationship there. There's also kind of a murder mystery, and it is a really good coming of age story as well, because she sort of learns about setting healthy boundaries with other people. There's also Jack of Hearts, brackets, and other parts, which is about a high school boy who is gay and sexually active and very open about his lifestyle, and is asked to run an online advice column called Jack of Hearts. It's supposed to be anonymous, but everyone works out who he is pretty quickly. And it all gets very, very difficult when not only gay people are coming to him for advice, for advice about very graphic stuff like, you know, cleaning up before you have anal sex kind of thing, which is why this book has had a lot of Beanie Babies thrown at it. But also straight couples are coming to him because he's very good at saying, this is how you set boundaries, this is where your parameters are, this is fine, there's no shame attached to this, this is normal. You know what, it's all right as long as you're practicing safe sex and you're communicating and you're being respectful of your partners to not want to settle down with somebody at your age. You know, this is perfectly normal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was a very healthy depiction. And if you want to go back to 1975... There's Forever by Judy Blume, which is a little dated in some ways, but was way ahead of its time in terms of depicting on-page sex between 18-year-olds. And it's about Catherine and Michael, and you know, it's a first love story for Catherine, and they decide they love each other, and they love each other forever, and they want to be together. And they're quite intense about it, and obviously they start having sex. And it's not that the parents object to. What they object to is kind of like, okay, you're making life-altering decisions like college and things based on the fact that you think you're going to love this person forever. Let's test it with a summer apart. And understandably, what happens being 18 is they drift apart over the summer. Or she drifts apart from him and ends up breaking his heart, which is quite sad. But it does teach you something as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So probably the next one, again, very, very familiar and has become very popular, is The Special Destiny.
Yes, let's give a teenager who's dealing with all the stuff that teenagers have to deal with something even worse, like an absolute nemesis. One great enemy.
Like a wizard Nazi.
Yes. Or you have Divergent, which again sort of feeds a little bit into the call to revolution trope. There are many, many examples of this one. I don't think it requires very much explanation.
No, I think that, people are relatively familiar with that one. So the next one is actually Self-Acceptance.
Yeah, this for me is a really interesting aspect of the coming of age narrative. The one that I particularly would talk about is Meg Rosoff's The Way I Live Now. The Way I Live Now is set in a near future, and Daisy, her real name is Elizabeth, but she prefers to be called Daisy, is sent to live with her mother's family in England for a summer. And she is extremely uptight. She's slightly OCD. She's suffering from an eating disorder. It's not really disclosed, but we think it's probably anorexia. And a lot of this is very internalized stuff from her mother's death. And because her father has got remarried and won't talk about her mother, so she's very alienated. And coming to live with her mother's family for a summer, even though it looks like the children are kind of neglected a little bit because they're just allowed to run wild on a farm and go to bed when they want and eat what they want. And, you know, the house is an absolute pigsty and the mother's an important diplomat. So she's always, always working. I think Daisy gets to speak to her twice before she's called off on some business. It's kind of like a real eye-opener for her because she suddenly realises what it's like to have a family that, you know, doesn't have secrets, that cares for each other. Yeah. She ends up getting involved with one of her cousins, which, you know, some people are going to be grossed out by, but this is two 15-year-olds and there's no power imbalance here. They just fall for each other. and, you know, start having underage sex, etc.
Which, right.
We're not really surprised because, you know what, they're teenagers, they're full of hormones. It's actually a very true depiction, and honestly, it's a consenting relationship, so I'm kind of like, yep, stop. But what's really interesting for me is the fact that against this backdrop of, you know, found family from actual family, a war with dirty bombs and things starts happening, and nobody's really sure what's going on there. And, you know, the two older boys, the twins, get drafted into the war, and Daisy and her little cousin, I think it's Lucy, I'm not sure, get sent off to be land girls, basically. You know, they never hear from the mother of the, you know, they never hear from Daisy's aunt again. She goes off to on some diplomatic peace summit thing and never comes back. They never hear from her. And, you know, soldiers just rock up to the farm one day and commission everything, you know, just take everything. And that before the boys and girls get divided, because obviously that's what happens. You send the boys off to learn to fight and you send the girls off to grow food in order to feed the soldiers as a first sort of example. As a first move, it's they promise that they'll find a way back to the farm together, and weirdly, against this backdrop, Daisy actually accepts herself. I won't say that, you know, fighting against a war and living on starvation rations is a way to get over anorexia, because I'm not saying this at all, but she suddenly realizes that a lot of the reasons that she's doing these things and she's imposing these things upon herself is for control. And now the world is so thoroughly out of control, she realizes the only thing she can actually control is herself. And her one goal is to take her cousin and get back to the rest of her family, the boys that she loves. So yeah, it's very gritty and it's quite moving, and it's incredibly sad as well. Some very sad stuff happens, but it's a really, really good book. Very difficult to get into, because initially all you get is really long sentences with about six ands in them. Like, it's just stream of consciousness.
Oh no, I could never read it.
I needed two runs up. But there's also a really good film that stars Saoirse Ronan as Daisy.
Okay.
And that is definitely well worth watching.
Would you think that there's an element of this in The Book Thief?
I think you could say there's definitely bits of, like, there's elements of the Call to Revolution or growing up in war times and self-acceptance, definitely, with both of those in The Book Thief.
Yeah. Because as you were just describing it, I suddenly thought, this parts of this are, like, tickling my Book Thief.
Your Book Thief land.
Yes, that special part of my brain which is just dedicated to The Book Thief.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, the final big trope collective is life, family, difficult issues, which work really, really well when you give them a speculative setting.
Yes, definitely. And I think that this is, again, a really prominent one because it's very realistic. One of the main things that a lot of people do face when sort of coming into adulthood is, first of all, the idea that parents aren't, as Jules said, gods. But the dynamic within a family, it's not just the relationships you have with, you know, romantic relationships. There is the family relationships, which are very difficult as well. So issues which come from home, which is meant to be this safe space, which is meant to be, you know, a core part of who you are, when that isn't quite right, or when there's an issue there, it will have a profound effect on how you develop as a person.
Yeah, definitely. So my example of choice for this one would be Holly Black's books, her fairy books, basically. And I say fair, it sounds like I'm saying something sweet like flower fairies, but if you read Holly Black, it's kind of like, no, you know, it's going to be gritty. There will be blood. There will be really fucked up family situations. I don't think she's written an unfucked up family dynamic yet. The prime examples are her modern fairy tales. So Tithe, Valiant and Ironside. And Valiant in particular, if you want to take an example, none of these show shining examples of parenting. But in Valiant, Valerie, who, you know, takes the nickname Valiant, comes home one day after being stood up by her boyfriend to find her boyfriend going down on her mother.
Oh, God.
And she walks out of the house again and gets on a train and shaves her head and just literally goes to live on the streets for a few months and falls in with this group of street kids who are injecting this stuff called Nevermore. So not heroin, but Nevermore. And what this stuff does is actually gives humans the ability to do fairy glamour. Right. And then she ends up sort of indebted to a troll because he catches her trying to steal from him. So she basically ends up indentured to work off this fairy debt kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... a lot of people found that book really difficult. And I get it because, you know, there's a lot of really fucked up shit going on there. There's the absolute... fail of all parenting fails. There's injectable drugs, so we're not just talking, oh yeah, we were smoking a bit of pot. It's a case of, no, we're literally giving ourselves track marks. We're living off shit and on the streets kind of thing. And
yeah.
Fairies are not nice creatures. Some of them are decent people, no. But they're not nice creatures. So it really does delve through the difficult family stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely.
A very hopeful ending, though. I'd like to point out.
Somehow. I think another one which really comes through with this trope is, not trope, but that this particular branch, is also death in the family. And this is actually one that you get frequently in middle grade rather than YAs, but sort of older middle grade.
Yeah.
The idea of a loss within the family dynamic, or divorce, or something like that as well, which is also a big part of, you know, growing up. Again, that development of also understanding that relationships, that other people's relationships exist outside of you. Divorce in particular, when, you know, you have a story which is my mummy and my daddy don't love each other anymore.
Yeah.
And is that my fault? And, you know, you get these stories where suddenly Jacqueline Wilson, for instance, really plays a lot on this, on the idea of the family dynamic and how it affects sort of young people. But also the conclusion often of the stories is that the young person is able to say, this is not my responsibility. It's not my fault, and life is okay and can continue. But I've grown up a little bit. I've learned to understand that relationships and life is difficult, not just for me, but for everybody.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, that's definitely one which is used a lot. And Jacqueline Wilson. Is it Jacqueline or Jacqueline?
I thought it was Jacqueline, but I have to admit, I've never actually read any of her books because she sort of came along quite a lot after me. So after I'd have been in her target audience.
She definitely kind of really plays on that. And she does it, you know, she writes all sorts of things, you know, stories about child abandonment, about the adoption system, about divorce, about abuse. I think she actually really does it. It's funny because sometimes, you know, she's a little bit mocked for always, you know, having, oh, such dire home situations. And I'm like, actually, I like the way that she addresses these difficulties. I like the way that she, you know, and I think Tracy Beaker is also Jacqueline Wilson.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And I think it's that they work as the perfect narrative for young kids to be reading these things to sort of understand actually how the world works around them, but also for that to take off that pressure which is put on so many young kids of responsibility for how other people act, because along with that whole idea of the world revolves around me, which is natural for young kids to feel, and you know, for slightly older kids to feel, that also then means that when something goes wrong, they feel responsible for it. They feel like it is their fault. And so to have narratives which actually say, it's not your fault, it's just the way the world works sometimes, is incredibly important, and I think that it works very, very well, particularly in middle grade, upper middle grade.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so moving on very briefly to where attempts at a coming-of-age narrative doesn't work. Not particularly naming any names here, but just things to consider. So, it, you know, when we say young adult, what we really mean is sort of 12 to 21. And, you know, there's obviously a spectrum within that, so you wouldn't be writing something for everybody within that age bracket. Yeah. In fact, you might even be thinking 21 to 25 bracket as well, which technically is new adult, but that label's never really quite taken off. So the problem is when your young adult protagonists, anywhere within that age group, are literally just fully formed adults, but you've made their age appropriate for the story you want to tell, and yet they're not actually representative of that age group.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, and you might argue with me on this, weirdly enough, I do think that this is something that Six of Crows suffers from a little bit. In that when I did read Six of Crows, and you know me, I'm always praising Six of Crows, but at no point did it, like, it said, oh, they're around 17, and my brain went, no, they're not. And that was that. They were all just adults.
Yeah, they were all they read as mid-20s. I would say
they did.
A lot of books in that sort of speculative category, so Six of Crows, the Grishaverse in general, Twilight again, they don't read like teenagers. I mean, obviously the vampires in Twilight probably shouldn't, because they're hundreds of years old.
Yeah.
Even though they're sort of technically physically 17 or whatever. But
yeah. I mean, there is a little bit in the case of, weirdly enough, I do think some of the characters, you do get that a little bit. So like with Jasper, for instance, you know, there is that sense of him kind of understanding why he behaves in the way that he behaves. But it feels more like an adult. It doesn't feel so much of coming of age, and more like just one of those other, you know, little hills that we talked about. So, yeah, that was definitely one which I read it. I'm like, this is a great YA, but it is not coming of age.
Yeah, and I don't think it was trying to be. I mean, all young adult needs to be coming of age, and vice versa.
No.
But that is the thing. I mean, if you don't include the struggles of a young adult with your speculative fiction elements, then you are not writing a coming of age story, and you don't get to call it one.
Yeah.
What makes me think about the young adult protagonists that are just fully formed adults, the veneer of young age on them, a few years, is what you were saying the other day about, was it a Twitter thread where someone was saying, oh, it's so gross when you have someone in their 20s or 30s sort of saying how much they fancy a fictional character who's 17. And you're like, well, it's perfectly normal, because they're actually not a 17-year-old in that narrative. They're clearly just someone who's, you know, the author has said they're 17, but they're clearly an adult.
Yeah. I do think that there's the fictional side of it. It's, again, like, this is one that I'm not going to wade in on this, because honestly, but yeah, it there is an element of the fact which is, yeah, you see these people and they're like, it's a teenager, and it's a little bit like that whole Hollywood thing whereby you have you know, someone's all these people like, these are teenagers, and they're being portrayed by
25-year-olds
who are in their, well, like, 20s and 30s. I mean,
yeah, you mentioned Grease earlier. Olivia Newton-John playing an 18-year-old was 30 years old at the time, and you know, that's great, and she obviously looked amazing for her age, but she wasn't 18, so.
No. And I do think that happens a lot, in that, yeah, you do get these stories which are not actually about teenagers at all. They've been put in sort of the teenage category for the sake of probably the setting, but they themselves are not behaving like teenagers. They're not going through anything which is actually a teenage story at all. And they are also not, you know, talking, because honestly, I think if they were behaving like teenagers, there are very few people outside of other teenagers who'd be like, yeah, that's attractive.
With Twilight, for example, it is a case of, you get the impression that maybe the author wanted to write a sex-free romance.
Yes.
She wanted that to be less of a question early on, and therefore that was why it was set kind of... And also, it's a first love thing, so you'd kind of expect it to be someone who is 17, wouldn't you, rather than someone who is 27, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think that it is something that frequently happens. And again, that's not to say not all YA needs to be a coming-of-age story. But there is a question of actually how do we portray teenagers?
Yeah.
And are we portraying them realistically? Because as I said, I did read Six of Crows and suddenly go, wait, they're meant to be 17? And I did see someone say, oh, look at this interaction. This is where you really see their teenagers. I'm like, this is an interaction that I might have with my friends. And I'm definitely in my 20s. Like, this is nothing teenagery about any of them.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, we've definitely come upon the end of our episode, I think.
We have. But yeah, as we said, there definitely was a lot to talk about here because we've run over. We'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on this, guys. Are you a big fan of the coming-of-age story? Do you actually feel like we should actually have a little bit more coming-of-age for sort of older readers as well? Because it doesn't all necessarily happen all at once in that one particular place. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Can you think of any great examples of coming of age stories? And can you think of examples which have really, really failed for you? Let us know. Remember, you can get in contact with us on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can get in contact with us individually, and we're both available on Tumblr and again Facebook and Twitter. So do let us know. Please leave us your comments. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, not coming of age, but featuring two teen protagonists. This is an Amazon original film, and it's called In the Vast of Night. And it's been a bit of a sleeper agent, but it's definitely got a lot of positive reviews, and I can see why. It's almost like somebody said, let's make a classic episode of The Twilight Zone, and we'll set it in the mid to late 50s, and we'll have all that sort of, you know, aesthetic and everything, and we'll make it kind of a spooky alien sci-fi mystery type thing. So what you're doing is you're following two kids. One of them's working as a phone operator, the other one is working as a sort of basically a talk show host on a local radio, and they pick up a strange signal. And as you carry on through the film, it transpires that occasionally we get visited, and they're basically trying to track down what exactly is happening. I don't want to spoilify it for anybody. It's really worth just going in and watching it. It's a very, very good film, and with one of the most amazing, sort of, basically all in one shot motion shots I've ever seen. It's really, really cool. I was like, oh my god, did they do that with just one shot? And I know now how they did it, but it looks amazing the way they did it. So yeah, if you like sort of the 50s aesthetic and sort of the Twilight Zone feel, but you want something with a slightly more modern take on it, definitely try out The Vast of Night.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. Hope you're keeping well. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.